SWIA's mission and 135 space shuttle missions. We would put people on the moon 6 times, and we would put up 2 space stations. All of that in 50 years, and we would lose 3 crews, 1 in a ground test accident and 2 in flight. Anybody who knew anything about the development of practical aviation would say, "What? Only 3? The agency's critics would argue that this attitude has permeated well beyond a refusal to abandon their comrades in their hour of need. The expectation of perfection reflects an institution that sets the highest standards, which the U.S. Space Agency sets out to be. But drifting down to technical departments that depend on delivering success to win funding from Congress, an aversion to mistakes becomes an obstacle to taking the risks that bring real innovation. The most expensive way to run a program is doing so in a fashion that ensures you'll never break a piece of hardware, Griffin told me. And, as any investor will tell you, without risk, there is little reward. I thought maybe we had a 10% chance of doing anything, of even getting a rocket to orbit, Musk would say of his company when it opened its doors in April 2002. Luke Nosek, who helped build PayPal with Musk and later joined the rocket company's board of directors, underscored the doubts of the time. So many of his friends advised him not to do SpaceX. Yet, Musk's pitch to become a rocket maker was somewhat similar to those for his other companies. Just as DARPA served as the initial impetus for the Internet and underwrote a lot of the costs of developing the Internet in the beginning, it may be the case that NASA has essentially done the same thing by spending the money to build sort of fundamental technologies, Musk told a classroom full of budding entrepreneurs at Stanford a year after SpaceX's inception. Once we can bring the sort of commercial free enterprise sector into it, then we can see the dramatic acceleration that we saw in the Internet. The initial team, besides Musk, included Cantrell, Mueller, and Chris Thompson, another Boeing engineer who flew rockets with Garvey in Mojave. 2 other early employees came from Microcosm, the small space company that built the first composite tank that launched. One, an assertive engineer with sales experience, was Gwen Shotwell. She was put in charge of business development when Cantrell left in the year after the company was founded. The other, a craggy German named Hans Königsmann, would become the company's chief engineer. At the time, the company consisted of little more than a carpet and a mariachi band that played when a dozen new employees inaugurated a new office in the Los Angeles suburb of El Segundo, in the backyard of the big prime contractors. A few months later, the startup had 1 other important advantage: capital. The online retailer eBay, which was battling Amazon to be the Internet's top purveyor of goods, purchased PayPal for $1.5 billion, just months after it had gone public. Musk's share of the proceeds was massive, and he immediately committed $100 million of his own money to SpaceX. Overnight, it had become the best-funded space startup in existence. If SpaceX wanted dramatic acceleration, it only had to build a rocket. As it turned out, Musk was not the only Internet guy seeking tutorials from veteran aerospace engineers, reading up on rocketry and plunging into arguments for exploring the solar system. By 2000, just 6 years into its existence, Amazon.com wasn't just a bookstore, but a juggernaut, and Jeff Bezos was worth more than $2 billion. At age 36, he, like Musk, was devoting more time to his personal passions. 2 years before Musk opened SpaceX's doors in El Segundo, Bezos had registered Blue Origin, listing its address as Amazon's headquarters. No one outside the space community really noticed. The company was very notional in its early years, but by 2003, journalist Brad Stone had managed to break the story about it for his employers at Newsweek. Tipped off to the existence of the company, Stone used a records request to discover its address, which by this time was a nondescript warehouse. Sifting through the trash cans, he found drafts of a mission statement talking about the long-term goal of an enduring human presence in space and plans to build a suborbital spacecraft named after Alan Shepard. When Stone asked if Bezos was motivated by frustration with NASA, the entrepreneur delivered a paean to the space agency's virtues. "The only reason I'm interested in space is because they inspired me when I was 5 years old. The only reason any of these small space companies have a chance of doing anything is because they get to stand on the shoulders of NASA's accomplishments and ingenuity." The first rule of American space entrepreneurship is don't piss off NASA. He told Stone that any comment about Blue Origin was way premature because we haven't done anything worthy of comment. Bezos had also been an avid customer of science fiction as a young man, and he harbored a lifelong interest in space exploration. A former girlfriend told reporters in the 90s that his business success was driven by his desire to go to the stars himself. According to Stone, Bezos' high school Victorian address had proposed the idea of saving humanity by creating permanent human colonies in orbiting space stations while turning the planet into an enormous nature preserve. You get the idea. The vision that captivated Bezos still drives him now. It is a different strain of space economic utopianism than the one that drives those who propose colonizing Mars, and it holds itself out as the more pragmatic approach. In this narrative, kickstarted by Gerard O'Neill's 1976 book, The High Frontier, the fragility of the human species on Earth is intimately connected to industrialization, the way the massive use of fossil fuels to drive the economy has altered the ecosystem. Instead of taking humans away from the planet and into space, why shouldn't the space industry develop the ability to put heavy industry up there in the cosmos? The vast renewable energy of the sun, the raw materials found on asteroids, and the ability to protect the Earth from pollution present an attractive argument for a zoning rewrite on a planetary scale. Beyond the resources, there is also the advantage of microgravity, which allows for advances in materials not available on Earth. Already, firms are experimenting with making ultra-fast fiber optic cable in space because it can be constructed with fewer impurities in orbit. "It's not rocket science, it's simply straightforward industry," argues Phil Metzger, a planetary scientist and former NASA engineer. "We have centuries of experience now in developing the machines of industry, so all we have to do is adapt those machines to another environment, and we already know how to do that, too." When the International Space Station was not yet complete, ideas for megaprojects in space were beyond far-fetched. Undaunted, Bezos began to fly groups of space experts up to his home base outside Seattle for private symposiums on the Apollo program, rocket design, and space economics. "We all were working with Jeff in secret in this Friday afternoon space club, as we called it," Cantrell told me. Bezos, too, looped into a crew of outside-the-box space engineers, many of whom overlapped with the crowd around Musk. Some were more outside-the-box than others. The science fiction author Neal Stephenson worked for Blue Origin, claiming to have been its sole employee for a time. His primary effort was thinking up ways to reach space that didn't involve rockets. These were ideas like propelling spacecraft with ground-based lasers or using space elevators, which would link the Earth to an orbiting counterweight by a cable that could be then climbed. The specific consensus is still that we don't yet have material strong enough to build such a chain, and Stephenson would eventually leave the company when it settled on a more conventional direction. He didn't leave without a little inspiration. His 2015 novel Sevenes featured a familiar character, a visionary billionaire with his own rocket company. The Amazon founder took a particular interest in a team of engineers from McDonnell Douglas, who had built and tested a prototype reusable orbital rocket called the DCX at White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico. It was designed to be the all-action reusable satellite launcher that the shuttle never was. But when NASA absorbed the DCX program, the agency lost patience and canceled it when a prototype was destroyed in a test flight. The team included numerous engineers who would go on to play important roles in commercial space. "That's where I learned rockets, out in the desert there," said Garvey, the former Boeing engineer. "You made things work with duct tape and wrenches and hammers." Their vehicle used rocket engines to take off vertically, maneuver thousands of feet above the desert, and lower itself to Earth, tail first, to land vertically again. The veterans of the program were proud of what they had accomplished and were frustrated that the promising technology had been scrapped. Ironically, several DCX veterans started off with SpaceX before joining Blue Origin. Cantrell says Musk had him fire several members of the team. Bezos's skill in exploring new markets, identifying the weaknesses in the biggest competitors, and exploiting them ruthlessly was already legendary in the business world. As he immersed himself in the space industry, his analysis identified the same central challenge that Musk would: the sheer financial cost of getting anything into space. Developing a cheap and reusable system to break free of Earth's gravity was a must for anyone with space dreams. Bezos will not deviate, he will not equivocate, and he fundamentally has this vision of Blue as millions of people living and working in space. Bob Smith, a veteran aerospace executive who became Blue's first CEO in 2017, told me, "How do you do that? There's a very logical trail. Well, the way you do that is you have to get operational reusability. Why? Because it lowers the cost. It makes it more available. It makes it more reliable. Makes it safe." The two entrepreneurs' vision of space affordability were similar enough that Svitek, who consulted for both Musk and Bezos and spent a year working at Blue Origin, encouraged them to meet and consider combining forces to avoid duplicating each other's efforts. In the summer of 2003, both flew to San Francisco for a sit-down. "I talked afterwards to both of them independently. They both said, 'Cool meeting, the guy is fun, we enjoyed it. We decided in the end to go our own ways,'" Svitek told me. Both Musk and Bezos have an aversion to the press, but Musk has an appreciation for how publicity can attract beneficial attention, interest from experts, public support, and investment. Though he had given up on his stunt probe to Mars for now, he still planned to use SpaceX to attract attention to the cause of space exploration, and would begin making outlandish predictions about its flight schedule almost immediately. Bezos preferred for his space company to stay quiet and shared little with the outside world, a practice that would endure for almost a decade. In its early years, Blue Origin appeared to be very much a company in the vanity project mode. Though it hired engineers and technicians, its staff didn't grow beyond a few dozen. It developed little hardware and had no product to sell. While his space company moved in fits and starts, Bezos himself was busy with Amazon. Unlike Musk, who early on was the chief manager of his space company, pushing it forward by strength of will, the similarly hard-charging Bezos was still running Amazon full-time. It was a period of huge expansion for the online company, as it went from national retailer to global force. In the years ahead, Amazon would begin releasing physical products, like the Kindle, a short-lived phone, and smart speakers for its AI assistant. It would be an early adopter of the growth in cloud computing and deploy its own proprietary servers optimized to allow other digital entrepreneurs to scale up their own services. Amazon Web Services became a huge moneymaker that ungirded a new generation of internet companies. Amazon established its own distribution centers and began investing in robotic technology to automate deliveries, even experimenting with drones for airborne package drop-offs. This period may have been a distraction from the work of making space cheaper to access, but it would pay off in literal dividends in the years ahead. The two rocket billionaires were similarly wealthy at the beginning of the century. But today, Amazon has allowed Bezos, depending on the vicissitudes of the market, to vie for the title of richest person on Earth. His personal net worth is estimated to be nearly $100 billion. There's a very real sense in which Amazon, which is an amazing, fun, interesting company to have started and lead, is a lottery winning for me, Bezos would say later. I'm taking those lottery winnings and investing them in Blue Origin. Lottery winners, like Musk and Bezos, aren't necessarily known for their follow-through. For years, Silicon Valley wags and space geeks alike wondered, when would they give up, like everyone else? Chapter 6. The Tyranny of the Rocket. Technology does not automatically improve. Elon Musk. The year 2003 began a brutal object lesson in the difficulties of flying human beings into space. Early on the morning of February 1st, the space shuttle Columbia appeared to observers at the Los Angeles headquarters of SpaceX as a white streak across the sky. It flew at 23 times the speed of sound, more than 200,000 feet above the Earth. The seven people on board had just completed a two-week scientific mission in orbit. But their attempt to return to Earth would be a death sentence. Returning from space, the shuttle orbiter must glide through the atmosphere, relying on its aerodynamic shape and stubby wings to remain aloft. The incredible velocity it reaches in these moments compresses the air in front of it, making the vehicle enormously hot, particularly on the front edge of the wings, which reach 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit. The aluminum structure of the orbiter is protected by special heat-resistant tiles so that it does not melt. But on Columbia, several of these tiles were missing or cracked. Superheated air insidiously pushed through the gap and ate away at the bones of the vehicle. On the ground, in the control room at Cape Canaveral, the NASA team awaiting the returning mission watched as heat sensors in the wing failed. It could have been a typical malfunction. Next, the sensors monitoring the landing gear inside the wing blinked out. Flight control then lost all signals from the orbiter. In truth, all of this wasn't uncommon during reentry. Minutes passed. The flight controllers assumed that the sensors were just on the fritz. They looked for radar evidence of the orbiter. It should have begun its descent toward the enormous runway at Kennedy Space Center by now. A cell phone rang. Cable news was showing imagery of the white streak across the sky, becoming multiple streaks. Columbia was lost. The flight director turned to a room full of NASA staffers and invoked the dreaded words that begin the evidence quarantine process following any aerospace disaster. Lock the doors. The inquiry board that examined the Columbia disaster didn't mince words in assessing the explosion, which left debris scattered across two states and 2,000 square miles. More than just an engineering failure and a tragic accident, Columbia was a blinking red warning signal for an institution that had seemingly lost its way. NASA itself was failing. The physical culprit behind the destruction of the orbiter was not a meteoroid or errant space hardware encountered while in orbit. Because the crew included Ilan Rahman, the first Israeli astronaut, some observers feverishly speculated about terrorist attacks or sabotage. In fact, the cause of death was a piece of foam, about the size of a beer cooler. It weighed perhaps 2 pounds. The foam was part of the space shuttle itself, One of the design compromises in the creation of the shuttle was an enormous orange external tank that carried the fuel and liquid oxygen used to power the orbiter into space before being jettisoned. In flight, the shuttle would roll and effectively fly upside down, with the tank above and in front of it. This was controversial, since it exposed the astronauts to danger. "I thought it was the dumbest thing I'd ever seen," one future NASA administrator said of the shuttle's rollout. When planning this maneuver, NASA engineers worried that the ice that formed on the metal surfaces of the external tank, when it was filled with supercooled liquid propellants, would fall on the orbiter and damage it. To prevent ice damage, they covered the fuel tank with spray-on foam insulation. Where the tank was joined to the rocket with aluminum spars, they sprayed over the joints with foam and cut it to form an aerodynamic shape. Experience had taught NASA that these foam ramps could break off during launch, but the launch managers initially didn't see this as a flight risk. Instead, it was something they had to remember to replace while refurbishing the reusable vehicle. This was an enormous mistake. When Columbia took off in January 2003, the foam ramp broke off its external tank almost a minute and a half into flight. It hit the left wing moving about 500 miles per hour and tore through the protective heat shielding. Exactly how deeply? We have no idea. NASA officials refused to ask their colleagues at the Pentagon to peek at the wings with a spy satellite or a ground telescope, and no astronauts were sent on a spacewalk to assess the damage. Despite serious misgivings among the engineers on the ground, the mission's managers did little to address the problem or even warn the astronauts about the enormous risks they were taking simply by coming home. They crossed their fingers and hoped for the best. Even if an effort to inspect the damage had been made, there was little that could have been done to repair the problem in flight. During its investigation, NASA concluded that a hasty rescue mission with another orbiter might have saved Columbia's crew in time, though it would have faced the same risk from falling foam. Foremost among the reasons that NASA didn't go into full rescue mode was that the mission manager for Columbia was also in charge of preparations for the next mission. Investigators judged that this was a major conflict of interest, since any delay to address the debris damage or recognize the threat of the foam ramp would halt preparations for the next mission. The space shuttle team was reluctant to adopt any new delays at a time when the space agency was under intense pressure to complete its share of the ISS. For all the thousands of hours spent inspecting engines, worrying about filters to keep the mix of breathable air right in the orbiter, and even stationing extra security around the launch site in case of a terrorist attack, NASA had missed the danger posed by the anti-ice foam. And not just missed it, but forgotten about it, according to the Accident Investigation Board. Early in the life of the space shuttle, foam debris was considered a serious problem. As flight after flight went off without a hitch, engineers got complacent and didn't investigate what might happen in a worst-case scenario. The investigators identified a disturbing number of parallels between the destruction of Columbia and the Challenger disaster 17 years earlier, where a rubber ring had been the cause. In both cases, worried engineers were challenged by managers to prove conclusively that their vehicle was unsafe, without being given the resources to do so. Building an institution that performed the complex engineering tasks of spaceflight on budget and on schedule, while avoiding complacency and buck-passing, still remained beyond the reach of the U.S. space program. Amazingly, while this tragedy registered at the moment, it also seemed to fade quickly from the country's collective memory. In comparison with the Challenger disaster, the loss of the Columbia had less of a cultural impact. Perhaps because it was the second such tragedy, but surely also because of national distraction. 4 days after the accident, Secretary of State Colin Powell, would present his flawed case for an invasion of Iraq to the United Nations General Assembly. American and coalition military forces would enter the country in mid-March, and coverage of the war and the protests surrounding it dominated the national consciousness in the months ahead. At NASA, however, there was little else to discuss. Heads rolled at the space shuttle program that year after the investigation was completed. The space community shared a collective sadness, tinged with a fear that the tragedy would also sour the public on expensive human spaceflight programs. But though Columbia was the final nail in the space shuttle program's coffin, ensuring that there would be no appeal of cancellation in 2010, it didn't change the shape of the industry. In a sense, the lessons of 1986 and 2003 were the same. NASA simply did not have a cheap, reliable space vehicle. Nor did it seem likely that one would appear soon, as the accident investigators noted. The changes we recommended will be difficult to accomplish, and will be internally resisted. The place to be in America if you wanted to solve the problem of cheap access to space was SpaceX's small factory in El Segundo, California. Rockets are the fastest vehicles ever to have carried humans. The spacecraft they have launched are the fastest moving objects built by humanity. This is by necessity. Escaping Earth's gravity, establishing a sustainable position in orbit, comes down to a mathematical expression that can be surmised as fly faster than you're falling. The magic number to reach orbit is about 17,500 miles per hour. At that speed, you are flying away from the Earth fast enough that its gravity carries you around the planet, but not into it. For comparison, a 747 jetliner's cruising speed is about 550 miles an hour, and the record for the fastest manned aircraft comes in at just over 4,000 miles per hour. And that was set in the X-15, an experimental rocket plane. Orbital velocity is just the beginning, since you must go even faster if you wish to leave Earth entirely and visit the Moon or other planets. The human speed record is still held by the three astronauts on the Apollo 10 moon mission, who returned to Earth at a speed of 24,791 miles an hour. There are other magic numbers in the rocketry business. Konstantin Shokovsky, a Russian mathematician and rocket theorist, derived many of these expressions at the turn of the 20th century. The self-educated child of Russian peasants, he contemplated, on paper, technological theory that would not be realized for more than half a century. You will not be surprised to learn that he was an early enthusiast of Martian settlement. More practically, he was the first to derive the important relationships between the amount of propellant a rocket must carry and its weight, and between its propellant and its destination. Remember that rockets must carry all their own fuel and oxidizer, since, in order to burn anything in space, you must bring all the ingredients. There's no oxygen hanging around. Once we know how much energy we need to get to orbit, at least enough to move 17,500 miles per hour, and how much energy a given propellant mix can generate, we know exactly what percentage of the vehicle's total mass needs to be propellant in order for the rocket to reach its destination. The effects of this rule are known as the tyranny of the rocket equation, and the physics are despotic indeed. Consider that a common rocket propellant in use today, a mix of ultra-refined kerosene and liquid oxygen, requires that an orbital rocket be 94% propellant by mass. That's an extraordinary number as compared with an automobile, where 3% of its mass is fuel, or even a jet fighter, where the figure is 30%. And for a rocket, too little propellant or too much mass means disaster, since there isn't a lot of margin for error when you are moving that quickly at that altitude. Margins that small mean that the simplest techniques that engineers use to deal with problems, like over-engineering parts to withstand more force than they might be expected to endure, aren't as easy in a rocket. There are ways to improve this figure. The most common is called staging, which, in effect, stacks multiple rockets on top of each other. In flight, once the first rocket's fuel is exhausted, its structure, tanks, and heavy engines all drop away. Now you can start your rocket equation over again at a much higher altitude and velocity, so your vehicle carries a higher ratio of rocket to propellant. That is, more weight. That is why the space shuttle used a discardable fuel tank and solid fuel rocket boosters to achieve liftoff. The ratio refers to the mass of the propellant versus the rest of the rocket, which includes the vehicle itself, the metal structure, the plumbing, the electronics, the engines. That's before we get to the payload, and if the payload involves humans, the systems needed to make sure those humans can breathe, eat, drink, go to the bathroom, and not get broiled or frozen alive. The space shuttle's launch mass was 85% propellant, 15% rocket, but only 1% of its mass was payload carried to orbit. It weighed more than 2,000 tons on the launch pad fully loaded, but it carried just 20 tons of people and cargo to space. These fundamental physical and mathematical laws, expressed here in their most basic form, were the dominant and cold realities that SpaceX's engineers faced as they sought to build the first privately funded orbital rocket in U.S. history. They had an initial budget of roughly $100 million, but that was a fairly small sum compared with the $500 million the government had given to both Boeing and Lockheed 5 years before to develop their own rocket engines, on top of which they made their own significant investments. Expectations for SpaceX were not high outside of its offices. It was just the next blastoff. Even his earliest advisors were skeptical of Musk's ambitions. At the start, the entrepreneur envisioned his first rocket being ready for launch in November 2003, less than a year and a half after the company opened its doors. He had very aggressive schedules and assumptions about what could be done that didn't sync up with what I thought was possible for a brand new rocket company, John Garvey, who had brought Musk into the world of rocket makers, told me later. Garvey decided not to join the company as its business plan grew more ambitious, preferring to pursue his small satellite rocket. He was a veteran of Boeing's rocket development cycles and took that experience to heart. Delta III was done by professionals who had a history building rockets. It cost $300 million or something. It took a couple of years and it took a couple hundred people, and then it wasn't successful initially, he told me. How can you beat that? Even if you bring in the smartest people and do everything from scratch, you can't knock that down by a magnitude. On the one hand, Garvey was right. Musk's very ambitious schedule would never be met. His optimistic expectations, often shared in the press, gave Musk a reputation for overpromising. At the same time, as we'll see, the promised product usually arrived. But the tension between schedule and reality often drove SpaceX's employees up the wall and would become a constant challenge for the company to manage. But the high expectations that Musk set helped create a powerful culture of accountability at the company, reminiscent of the kind of shoestring projects that Garvey and SpaceX's early employees learned their craft on. Those programs which are fast-paced and exciting, and you shut the door and work 24 hours with the techs. This culture would be the company's most powerful early advantage. I was trying to figure out why we had not made more progress since Apollo, Musk told a roomful of Stanford students in 2003, a few months after the Columbia disaster. We're currently in a situation where we can't even put a person into low Earth orbit, that doesn't really gel with all of the other technology sectors out there. The computer that you could have bought in the early 70s would have filled this room and had less computing power than your cell phone. And so just about every sector of technology has improved. Why has this not improved? To Musk, the now grounded space shuttle was incredibly expensive and really quite dangerous. Boeing and Lockheed's government-designed plan to build new rockets was likely to exceed both its bloated multi-billion dollar budget and its timeline. The Suyuz, while considerably cheaper, considerably safer than U.S. vehicles, was unlikely to prompt a revolution in space access as long as it was owned by economically failing Russia. The way forward to ultimately surpass all of that stuff is entrepreneurial space activities where things are led by the spirit of free enterprise. The stockholders and management of the major space contractors who actually produce all this hardware may not appreciate Musk's characterization of their enterprise as something other than free. Yet their own employees, or any economist, could quickly identify the problem with that argument. The prime contractors were frequently monopolists, locking down control of a single aerospace franchise, and in turn, they frequently served a single customer, the government. This gave them the ability to demand contracts with a guaranteed profit, which critics of these arrangements say undermines the very profit-maximizing urges that drive innovation. Cost-plus contracts are extremely good for shareholders, but they shouldn't be mistaken for competition. In a few years, Musk would become perhaps the only aerospace CEO to insist on fixed-price government contracts, and SpaceX would become a dramatic example for procurement reform. But shortly after opening its doors, SpaceX was a startup where everybody does a billion things and you don't know what you're really going to do until you start, as Gwen Shotwell put it later. She was employee number 11 at the company. Hired after visiting a former coworker for our tour of SpaceX's first office. At the outset, she was charged with bringing in customers for the as-yet-unbuilt rocket, a task which would grow to all aspects of the company's external relations, from regulatory approvals to legal to mission integration. Hiring Shotwell would turn out to be an inspired choice, though it would be years before Musk handed her operational control of the company. Shotwell combined her serious technical background and no-nonsense Midwestern attitude with a sense of flair that stood out. She had decided to pursue engineering as a career when, as a child, she attended a Society of Women Engineers forum with her mother. She listened to a speaker who combined marvelous shoes and a matching bag with self-assured competence. Whatever a mechanical engineer was, well, that was what Shotwell wanted to be. Now in charge of selling a rocket that didn't exist yet, she met potential clients while wearing crisply tailored pantsuits and walking on sky-high heels, in stark contrast to the more disheveled engineers roaming the facility in sneakers. The lack of a product to sell didn't daunt her. For Shotwell, SpaceX's biggest advantage in designing the new rocket was being able to start with a clean sheet. We did not have to evolve the launch vehicle. Instead, the team could ask, what are the smart things that we want to do to make this vehicle highly reliable but still low cost? More often than not, the space program had focused on enormous projects like the space shuttle that were designed to satisfy every possible user, from the military to the science community to satellite companies. But the first SpaceX rocket was designed to be what a tech startup would call a minimum viable product. Basically, the cheapest thing you could build that would attract paying customers. From there, the company could iterate and expand its offerings. Their minimum viable product would be called the Falcon 1. Yes, it's a reference to the Millennium Falcon of Star Wars fame. Space pop culture helped animate SpaceX and make it unique. It didn't name its rockets after Greek gods like Titan or Apollo, or use bureaucratic speak like the Space Transportation System, as the space shuttle was officially known. Even the individual shuttle orbiters' names, Enterprise, Columbia, Challenger, Discovery, Atlantis, and Endeavour, harked back as much to the virtues of dowdy Victorian explorers as they did to the future imagined by the people building them. If established rocket makers thought that SpaceX looked silly for naming its spacecraft after a literal flight of fancy, the company's broader mission to attempt to colonize the solar system certainly led them to scoff. But embracing the grand operatics of space was exactly what had brought the best engineers to SpaceX and made them willing to work long hours on mind-bending engineering projects. The reason I joined the company, one of the key differentiators of our culture, is intense mission focus, Brian Bielda, the company's head of human resources, told me. In August 2003, Bielda was the seventh employee at the company and the program manager for the Falcon 1. Elon founded this company to revolutionize access to space with the ultimate goal of making humankind a multiplanetary species. There are a lot of people in the industry today that can rally behind that mission, and the focus is on Mars. But the Falcon 1 was not designed to go straight to Mars. It was simply a first step toward the red planet. It was to figure out the basics of rocketry, Musk told me of the project. We didn't know anything. I'd never built anything before. Shotwell called it our practice rocket. The Falcon 1, which was developed from the original spreadsheet over those many weekend bull sessions, was designed to fly small satellites. Though it would carry less weight than its competitors, a maximum expected payload of about 1 ton, to low Earth orbit, about 200 miles up. It would cost only $6 million, far less than the bigger vehicles available at the time. With the space shuttle grounded, the space station unfinished, and expendable orbital launch vehicles costing more than $150 million per flight, there was little opportunity for small companies or researchers to test hardware in space, even as the miniaturization of electronics made such experiments increasingly attractive. SpaceX's engineers thought a low-cost alternative that could bring satellites to orbit on demand would quickly find a market, and they wouldn't have to worry about competing directly with larger vehicles built by Lockheed Martin, Arianespace, and the Russian aerospace industry. There was another angle to play. Ever since the Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI, of the 80s, aka Star Wars, the military had been eager to find a way to quickly deploy small satellites into space. That had been a key motivator behind the DCX project. One of SpaceX's earliest customers was DARPA, the Pentagon's high-tech research division, which wanted to quickly deploy and operate small satellites in response to potential conflicts. That was a key thing. You have only a handful of satellites and your opponents knock them out, you're kind of screwed, Air Force Brigadier General Pete Warden, a veteran of the SDI, told me. After retiring from active duty in 2004, Warden advised DARPA in its competition in search of small rockets, and SpaceX's Falcon 1 was selected. To service this market, the engineers came up with one of the most basic designs they could. Every decision we've made has been with consideration to simplicity, and the reason for simplicity is because that both improves the reliability as well as reduces your cost, Musk said in 2003. If you've got fewer components, that's fewer components to go wrong and fewer components to buy. The Falcon 1 would end up being 70 feet tall and comprise two stages, each with one engine. Working from equations grounded in Shokovsky's ironclad laws about the relationship between mass, propellant, and orbital velocity, the team began developing the structure of the rocket, its frame and skin, the tanks of propellant, the plumbing that would carry the propellant to the all-important engine, and then the brains of the rocket, the guidance and navigation system that would communicate with the outside world and direct it in flight. The engineers, many with experience working at the prime contractors, had some immediate ideas about what not to do. Their 30-person team and small office represented a far lower cost of doing business than that faced by their competitors, and the company intended to keep it that way. They did their best to look ahead to every stage of the manufacturing and flight processes in order to ensure that the entire system supporting the vehicle could function as efficiently as possible. Deceptively simple ideas came with surprising savings. For example, many rocket companies assemble or test their vehicles vertically, in the same way they are launched. SpaceX chose to keep its rockets horizontal, virtually until it was time for them to fly. That meant they could use regular commercial warehouse space at 50 cents a square foot instead of constructing a high bay space, essentially a hollowed-out skyscraper, at a cost of $30 to $40 per square foot. The decision came with other benefits, too. Workers clambering around 60 feet in the air require extensive safety equipment, training, and expensive insurance. Workers clambering around 12 feet in the air is a much cheaper and more manageable safety problem. Another simple idea, mass production. While you might imagine rocket manufacturing as a kind of Detroit-style assembly line populated with robots and automation, the truth is that launch vehicles are mostly bespoke products, made to order for their customers. A dozen rockets a year represented a huge book of business for rocket companies, but a dozen of anything is a small batch in the world of precision manufacturing. Rockets were handmade by highly trained technicians and assembled largely by hand. SpaceX, however, adopted a different philosophy. High-volume production tends to lead to lower costs, so let's get in the higher production mode, Shotwell said of the approach at the time. And by the way, those vehicles are more reliable than the artisan-crafted, like a Honda is more reliable than a Ferrari. Ferraris are beautiful, but Honda is more reliable. At a traditional aerospace firm, much of this development would be farmed out to subcontractors. But at SpaceX, engineers insisted on figuring out almost every single aspect of the vehicle themselves. Hans Konigsmann developed the avionics systems for the Falcon 1 before becoming SpaceX's launch chief engineer. Prior to SpaceX, he had earned a doctorate in his native Germany and then spent 5 years working on satellites in the United States. Musk recruited him to work at SpaceX after showing up at Konigsmann's house to interview him. The engineer was bemused at the effect his accent had on winning consensus around his ideas. A Pavlovian response built into American rocket engineers since the days of Wernher von Braun, perhaps. But he found it invigorating to be surrounded by the enthusiastic, work-hard-play-quake-hard crowd at SpaceX. In Germany, his professional home was an institution known by the acronym ZARM, roughly the European equivalent of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Konigsmann summed up both SpaceX and ZARM with Teutonic efficiency. Young people, we had good money for big projects. We did new stuff. Sometimes that new stuff required some literal outside-the-box thinking. At that point in time, I really felt that space technology fell behind the rest of the world, Konigsmann said later. The bottom line is, because of the relatively long development times you have in space technology, you don't fly the latest stuff. You fly the stuff that was around by the time you wrote the proposal. The downside of that is obviously that you're always 5 years behind, maybe 10 years behind or even more. That is something that we always wanted to avoid. We weren't ashamed to look at other places. What are cars doing? What's done in cell phones? What's the technology in batteries? And can we use that? Konigsmann, affectionately called the Falcon 1's avionics computer the ATM, because it was so simple, yet reliable enough to handle important activities, whether financial transactions or steering a rocket at Mach 5. The company's reluctance to get sucked into the high-priced world of space technology extended to slight subterfuge. Employees looking for potential subcontractors didn't say they were looking for aerospace parts, since that was a one-way ticket to high prices. "We try not to tell anyone outside the space business that it's for a rocket, because they assume rockets are made of magic," Musk would say later. "If there was something better out there, they'd use it. Instead of using traditional cables, giant copper bundles as thick as your arm, to connect the rocket's computers and electrical controls, they used simple Ethernet cables, which were lighter in weight and more reliable than the older cables. There are things like that which, when you add them all up, it makes a huge difference," Musk says. SpaceX sourced valves critical for controlling the plumbing of a rocket, the piping that carries propellant and the gases used to cool and pressurize the engine, from a company that primarily created the valves that inflated most of the life rafts used by the U.S. Navy. The first high-pressure tanks SpaceX's rockets used for storing fuel were subcontracted to a Wisconsin company called Spincraft that made metal silos for storing dairy products. Both companies were praised by Musk for their work, but the ever-impatient entrepreneur would soon bring as many tasks in-house as possible when he found that subcontractor delays were putting the Falcon 1 behind schedule. On one inspection trip, he reacted angrily to news of delays, telling a nearby worker that, "You're fucking us up the ass and it doesn't feel good." It was a blast of temper that SpaceX employees would become familiar with when deadlines neared and their boss's patience was running out. Yet Musk's directness, whether he was pleased or displeased, was also a prized asset at SpaceX. Executives and technicians alike soon learned that the CEO of their new company rarely played favorites when it came to business decisions. Early engineers like Bielda described an atmosphere where the best idea won and physics defined what was possible and what was not. Not status, price, or politics. Conversely, those who burned out or caught the bad side of a Musk tantrum might say that physics, while important for rockets, wasn't the right guidebook for managing people. Outside observers who worked with SpaceX would quickly notice a unique culture taking root at the company, where 80-hour weeks were the norm. At Lockheed Martin, it would never occur to a subcontract manager to say, "I don't like these bids. I think we could build this in-house for a third of the price," a veteran aerospace executive told me. They'd be met by a panel of engineers that would say, "This company does nothing but make rivets, and you're telling me we can make an individual single rivet for half the price?" Conversely, a NASA executive who spent years working with SpaceX remembered that employees would say, "Well, we could go buy this from this vendor, but it's like $50,000. It's way too expensive. It's ridiculous. We could build this for $2,000 in our shop." I almost never heard NASA engineers talking about the cost of a part. At SpaceX, however, Musk expected every single cent of his personal investment to be spent wisely, with speedy results. The engines are the most important and expensive part of any rocket, and at SpaceX, they were the responsibility of Tom Mueller. "When I started developing the Merlin engine, the conventional thinking was only governments can develop rockets," he told a group of students later. Mueller quickly found that, leaving aside price, aerospace vendors just moved too slowly for his boss. "If it takes them 2 weeks or a month to give you a quote, you've already got the wrong vendor," he said, recalling an estimate he received of hundreds of thousands of dollars for the part and it's going to take 18 months to develop it. "I'm like, no, I need it in 3 months," and they kind of laugh at you. Mueller's team began building parts in-house. They even considered powering the rocket engine with jet fuel, which, due to its wide availability, costs $4 per gallon less than the ultra-refined kerosene, RP-1, or rocket propellant 1, they would eventually settle on. The jet fuel just didn't run right in the engine. The company began its engine test efforts out in the Mojave Desert, naturally, borrowing an experimental setup from a company called X-Core Aerospace. It was one of the companies competing for the XPRIZE. SpaceX's early focus on a small, expendable rocket meant they wouldn't be competing, but their teams shared a try-anything spirit. The fledgling engineers at SpaceX, however, quickly outstripped the generosity of their compatriots and the patience of local officials with the pace of their testing, and it was clear they would need a place of their own to fine-tune the propulsion systems. After some consideration, they settled on 300 acres of land in McGregor, Texas, a remote town outside Waco. It had some history. A failed space startup, Beale Aerospace, founded by a billionaire Texas banker with a mathematical bent, had set up shop there in the 90s. It had been another attempt to profit from the planned satellite constellations that made it seem that a private launch company was a smart idea. Beale gave up in 2000, having tested a new rocket engine but never launching a vehicle. SpaceX would be able to save money by modifying some of the existing equipment to suit its purposes. Eventually, it would construct its BFTS, Big Fucking Test Stand. 100 feet tall with concrete legs, 10 feet in diameter, and extending 70 feet under the Earth, the BFTS would test engines that can generate 1,500 tons of thrust. At TRW, Mueller had tested rocket engines at Stennis Space Center, a major NASA facility in Mississippi, since the Apollo days. When firing engines, Stennis boasted a crew of 100 workers in two shifts. SpaceX would test the Merlin rocket with 10 people on hand. "It doesn't take an army of people to run an engine like that," Mueller said. "I think the government contractors have convinced themselves it does." The challenge of building a rocket engine isn't in the theory, but in the practice, optimizing a system that can handle the power needed to lift a rocket without destroying itself is no easy task. Rocket engines rely on components called turbopumps, akin to jet engines, to force propellant into combustion chambers at enormously high pressures and temperatures. The Merlin's combustion chamber operates at a pressure of more than 1,000 pounds per square inch, and the temperature reaches 6,000 degrees Fahrenheit, more than three times hotter than the melting point of steel. To avoid a catastrophic meltdown, the engineers lined the chamber with a coating of resin and silica fibers that would absorb heat and flake off, protecting the engine just long enough for it to drive the rocket into space. Exactly 160 seconds. The propulsion team spent 10-day shifts in Texas, bookended by long nights driving back and forth between the McGregor test site and their homes in Los Angeles for intermittent breaks. Sometimes they borrowed Musk's corporate jet, with an extra passenger cramming himself in the bathroom for the short hop between the two facilities. The effort progressed with frustrating slowness, and Musk didn't hesitate to let his engineers know that he wasn't happy with their pace. And in addition, things were going wrong. Test stands were blowing up. Engines were melting themselves well before their theoretical rocket would arrive in space. And cows were stampeding in circles in nearby fields, in natural abhorrence of such unearthly activities. The heart of the engine showed SpaceX's total obsession with simplicity, iteration, and efficiency. It was designed around something called a pintle injector. Mueller is credited with inventing the mechanism, which is the subject of SpaceX's first and only patent. It's a technology for mixing the liquid oxygen and kerosene in the engine's combustion chamber. Rather than push the fuel through a complex part with many small holes, a showerhead, the pintle is a simple bolt. It screws into place inside a pipe that injects the fuel into the combustion chamber. When the high-pressure flow of fuel hits the pintle, it sprays out to mix with the oxygen. In their quest to optimize the mix of propellant and fuel for maximum thrust, SpaceX's engineers could simply swap in and adjust new pintles, rather than remachining the entire engine. That meant they could iterate faster and test new designs to find the most efficient.